Today, we're rebroadcasting one of the most popular podcasts we've ever produced, originally aired in November 2006. Astronomer and scientist Carl Sagan was a pioneer in the field of astrobiology, the study of the origin, evolution, and future of life in the universe. He was also an advocate for a scientific worldview, one with no space for religion or creationism. Today, we sit in on a discussion between Sagan's widow, Anne Druin, his former colleague, Steve Soter, and Hayden Planetarium director, Neil deGrasse Tyson. They talk about Sagan's science and the search for God.
Anne, I was wondering if you could share with us, some people here might not be familiar with Carl Sagan's life. It has been 10 years. There might be some younger people in the audience for whom Carl Sagan is a distant memory, or perhaps they haven't even heard of him. If you could just give us a couple of minute overview on who Carl Sagan was to America, to the world, to the universe.
Okay, well, Carl Sagan was born in Brooklyn to a working class family. And from his earliest years, he was fascinated with the question of whether or not there was life elsewhere. And so, as Steve has observed, he was the first person of whom we know who decided to pursue a career in astrobiology before there was such a field. And to do that, he became an astrophysicist, studied biology, studied with the foremost experts on the question of the origin of life here, as well as experts on the planets. And he became a scientist, educated at the University of Chicago, and not only became a scientist, but from his earliest years, he had a passion to communicate to the broadest possible public audience the great power and the joy of scientific discovery. And at that time, there was a terrible professional penalty to be paid for doing that kind of public education. The community of science was very exclusive, kept out the women, kept out everyone who really wasn't a white guy, and they took a very dim view of anybody who would want to speak in the language of the public to communicate about what they were doing and why it was interesting. That was one problem. The other problem was that they also took a dim view of scientists who were pursuing their bliss, who became a scientist in order to answer these deep questions. And so even the question of whether or not there was life elsewhere, and if there was, what it would be like, was considered disreputable. And so when we think of Carl, I think the things that are most outstanding about him is that he was one of the pioneers in the science of astrobiology. He took his understanding of planetary atmospheres, was the first person to know the actual temperature of the planet Venus. He took his understanding, his scientific understanding of these other worlds, and applied it to our own world.
Very high temperature for Venus.
It was hot.
Yes.
Much hotter than anyone thought.
So it's not
thought.
Just finding a temperature. It
right.
was like finding
right.
a runaway
very high.
Greenhouse
Ooh,
effect.
Hot. Very
yes.
hot.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, so that was a very impressive thing. But then he also had this passion to communicate. So unlike his colleagues, he went on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson dozens of times, some 36 or 40 times, to talk about the missions to the planets. His life coincided very beautifully with the first 40 years of the space age. He was a participant in every one of NASA's missions until his death. And the great thing about him was that he was not ashamed to, or not too proud or too much of a snob, to want to write for, let's say, Parade magazine. Reached 70 million people every Sunday. And what he was trying to communicate was not only the latest findings, scientific findings, but also, as one of the authors of the nuclear winter paper, one of the first people to understand that there could be long-term climatic consequences in a full exchange of a nuclear war. He also had a tremendous social conscience. And his act of communication, of communicating about science, was a kind of passionate act of citizenship. He wanted to reach as many people as he could. He felt that the public was paying for all these great scientific missions, and he was the first person to convince NASA to put cameras on the spacecraft. So that NASA was saying, well, what do we need cameras for? We've got mass spectrometers. We've got all kinds of scientific instruments. What do we need cameras for? But Carl understood the great power of the imagery of sending spacecraft to Mars and to the outer solar system and bringing back these images of new worlds. He understood that we were living in a golden age of space exploration, and he wanted everyone to be a part of it. So he was an extraordinary person. He took a lot of abuse and flack for being such a powerful communicator, but in his Cosmos television series and the dozen books he wrote and the Pulitzer Prize-winning Dragons of Eden, he was daringly interdisciplinary, and as it was said of another great scientist, Edmund Halley, he was always ready to communicate.
Would you say that he was in the spirit of Galileo, where no one had ever written science in a language other than Latin before Galileo wrote in Italian? And Galileo writes about his scientific discoveries in Italian, which means ordinary common folk, literate common folk, could read it, not just the intelligentsia who were fluent in Latin. And so in a way, he was kind of breaking the traditions. Is this sort of the modern version of that, would you say?
Well, I would have to be honest and say that Lauren Eisley and some of the other scientists who came slightly just before Carl were also trying to do the same thing. But I think no one ever did it as effectively as Carl. He was a global figure. There wasn't a country on Earth, because Cosmos has now been seen by over a billion people. There wasn't a place on Earth where he walked, where people didn't come up to him and say, "Thank you for making me feel a part of the cosmos and for making me feel that I could understand the latest revelations of the modern scientific revolution."
Steve, you're a colleague of his. Mm-hmm. What was going on among his colleagues at the time that he was becoming popular?
Well, you mean in science or in...
Well, both, all of the above.
Well, in science, of course, it was, as Anne said, the golden age, the opening of a new age of exploration, of wonderful discoveries coming one on top of another, and he was in the forefront.
The discoveries brought by NASA.
By NASA spacecraft,
yes.
Principally, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And because he was taking these discoveries and the wonder of it to the public, because he was thrilled by it and wanted to share the excitement of it, he said, actually, when you're in love, you want to tell the world. And what he was talking about was his love, his passion for this science, for this new understanding. Because he was doing that, a number of his colleagues were actually aghast. They thought this was improper, undignified, that not people that knew him personally particularly, worked with him, but other people in the field. I thought that it was rather undignified for a scientist to be going to the public in this fashion.
Would they have preferred he just leave the public out of it? Even though, as Anne said, this is research funded by tax-based sources.
Well, I think they wouldn't object to articles in Scientific American, that sort of thing. But when he went on the Johnny Carson show, there was a lot of alarm. And in fact, I myself remember that I was somewhat alarmed. I didn't know how this would turn out. I thought this might be taking it a little too far.
You were against him going on the Johnny Carson show?
I think initially, when I heard about it, I was, although I didn't tell him that. But I had some concern that this might hurt him. But when I saw how beautifully he carried it off, and then subsequent interactions with Johnny Carson, how well it was working, how effectively he was communicating, how much the rapport between Carson and Sagan and the audience, I realized he had done the right thing.
And so did others agree with you?
I think most did, but there were certainly some who were quite bitter about it, always, and sniped at Carl and criticized him and tried to penalize him in the academic community, who blocked his being named to the National Academy of Sciences, for example, although he richly deserved it for his major scientific contributions.
And so how did you end up collaborating, ultimately?
Well, my principal collaboration with him really was on the Cosmos television series, I was at Cornell University when he arrived there in 1968, and I was delighted.
He came from Harvard, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. And they were not too happy with him at Harvard because of this kind of popularization.
He was already popularizing at Harvard.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I remember I saw him first on television in the early 1960s when I was a young undergraduate in astronomy. And I realized here was somebody who was talking about something that also passionately interested me and talking about it sensibly and in a serious scientific way about life in the universe. I myself had been interested in that, and I remember I had gone to one of my own professors in the astronomy department at UCLA to say that I thought I would like to also take a minor in biology because of this interest, and he all but threw me out of his office. That was the attitude then.
Was the attitude that biology had nothing to do with astronomy, or that the cross-pollination of the sciences would lead to no great insight? What would you say was behind the motive?
It was that this was not serious science. That there was...
You're looking for aliens,
yeah,
you mean?
Yeah.
It was science fiction.
And so, actually, that set me back. I did not pursue that. But Carl was made of sterner stuff. But I kept up my interest in this. And then, as a graduate student at Cornell in 1968, when I learned that he was coming there to where I was, mm-hmm. I was, of course, thrilled and delighted. And when we met, we immediately became fast friends and realized we had a lot of things in common and remained so until his death.
So, Annie, the lectures that became the substance of this book, what's the origin of those?
Well, in 1984, Carl was invited to give the Centennial Gifford Lecture the following year. Now, the Gifford Lectures were endowed by Lord Gifford for the four Scottish universities with the idea that the greatest theologians, scientists, philosophers would come and give an extended lecture series on the question of natural theology, which at that time in 1885 was described as everything to do with God without resorting to revelation. So it was basically a mandate to discuss the natural evidence for the existence of God or non-existence. And Carl was thrilled. Previous Gifford lecturers were Werner Heisenberg, Niels Bohr, Hannah Arendt, Freeman Dyson. It was a great honor. And of course, this was a chance for him to talk for 9 lectures and think about the existence of God, which was absolutely one of his favorite subjects. It's something we talked about endlessly together. So he did a huge amount of research, and what followed were the Gifford Lectures in 1985. And William James had given the Gifford Lectures in 1902, and he called his lectures, when he turned them into a book, The Varieties of Religious Experience, very influential book, still in print to this day, which was
William James, the psychologist?
One of the founders of modern psychology,
right.
Yes. And when I rediscovered the manuscript, the audio transcript of Carl's Gifford lectures, and began to read them, having witnessed them when they were given and remembered how mesmerizing they were, I was delighted to see that on the page they held up beautifully, coherent, just marvelous, crystalline series of arguments about the existence of God, ranging as wide as Carl's consciousness was, so including the question of extraterrestrial intelligence, what the extraterrestrials would be like, a wonderful piece on intelligent design, which back in 1985, Carl described as a kind of hydra that reappears every 5 or 10 years, and had been doing so since right just after the Second World War. And he gave the most exquisite description, the best, most compelling argument for intelligent design I have ever heard. Better than any proponent.
Do tell. I mean, if you're going to tell us the most exquisite ever, you can't just leave us hanging here.
I think actually Steve can do more justice to the fine scientific points of the argument. But my point is merely that it was very much in Carl's nature to try to give any opposing view its best expression. And for that reason, every time we wrote a book together or he wrote a book, he insisted on circulating the manuscript to the people who were most likely to disagree with the premises in the book so that they could make their best argument. And so in doing this intelligent design riff in the Gifford Lectures, he had the audience completely on the edge of their seat making this argument, and at the end of it, he totally demolished it. Brilliantly. And you began to realize how, you know, what the flaws in the logic were. Please, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the argument that he was advancing was this. It has been said that something as complicated as a living organism could not arise by natural processes. It needs a designer. If you found a pocket watch ticking away in the forest, you would assume that it had been made by an intelligent designer. And life is infinitely more complicated than a pocket watch. And a single cell is, and even a molecule of an enzyme, a protein, a very complicated molecule. What would be the chance of making a protein, say, 100 amino acid long protein, and there's 20 amino acids, and they all have to be assembled in a particular order? He did the calculation. How likely would that happen by chance?
This would be by random chemical experiments in warm ponds.
Yes. Well, in fact, he said if you had a chemical experiment going on in the ocean of every planet in the universe, billions of planets per galaxy, hundreds of billions of galaxies, and an experiment was going on every Planck time, which is the shortest conceivable time, something like 10 to the minus 34 seconds, for the entire age of the universe, you would not be able to assemble this molecule by chance. And he said, that sounds like a pretty strong argument, doesn't it? I mean, how does such a thing come to be? He cited an analogy by two astronomers, Hoyle and Wickram Singh, in England, saying this would be as improbable.
This is Fred Hoyle, to put him in context. Yeah. Fred Hoyle, who advanced the notion that heavy elements are forged in the centers of high-mass stars.
A brilliant astrophysicist, a major contributor, yeah.
Okay.
Hoyle and Wickram Singh said to find a living organism and to assume that that was something assembled by random processes is as unlikely as that a whirlwind going through a junkyard would assemble a 747. Okay? And then, let me just read you, if I may.
We would all be astonished if that happened, sure.
We would be
That's a vivid image. It's also a very useful image because, of course, this is Carl speaking, the Boeing 747 did not spring full-blown into the world of aviation. It is the end product of a long evolutionary sequence, which, as you know, goes back to the DC-3 and so on until you get to the Wright biplane. Now, the Wright biplane does look as if it were spontaneously assembled by a whirlwind in a junkyard. And while I don't mean to criticize the brilliant achievement of the Wright brothers, as long as you remember that there is this evolutionary history, it's a lot easier to understand the origin of the first example.
Well, that's a pretty clean case there. And, of course, even if you wanted to go earlier than...
five.
Pardon?
Wasn't it that you only needed a sequence of five?
The other case he makes is in this amino acid, in this enzyme, rather, with 100 amino acids, there's only five of them that are active sites. The rest of them really sort of hold it together. You don't need all of that detailed information. And the chance of getting five amino acids right is a manageable number. He said that will happen by a random experiment every second Tuesday.
Okay.
But he did the math.
Not on Wednesday, but on Tuesday.
He did the math in front of the audience, and he was holding them spellbind.
But even if the Wright flyer, if you wanted to give that more credit than is implied here, you can go back before then.
It goes back to Leonardo da Vinci, before that by people watching birds. And, of course, birds developed flight by this process of evolution.
And even some didn't.
Yes.
Like and penguins.
Well, then some lost it. And so what are the wings of a penguin? How intelligent is that?
Okay.
Good point.
I guess they're not for flying, at all. So, Annie, let me ask you. It's commonly remembered that Carl was an atheist. That's been said of him, but you knew him closest, perhaps. Is that an accurate description of him or not? How would you characterize his spirituality or his religiosity?
Well, in fact, he was not an atheist, and he once said that in some respects, an atheist was a very silly person, because the implication being that the universe is so vast, that we have so little knowledge. Our knowledge of the universe, we've only been systematically, scientifically investigating the universe for a mere four centuries. And so our knowledge of the universe is very superficial and very new. We're very ignorant. And so the questions of how the universe came to be, and if there was anyone involved in its creation, are still open questions. And he was truly an agnostic, and that's because science was his religion, and he viewed science as a form, as informed worship, as a way to search for the sacred, for the spiritual truths of life, but to do it with this phenomenally successful error-correcting methodology, which is always winnowing out those things that we want to believe, but that may not be true. We are great liars as a species. We lie to each other. We lie to ourselves. And so we need this the scientific method to constantly test, and the great to test reality, to test our perceptions of reality, because we're so often wrong. And of course, science is a permanent revolution. It never ends, because science reserves the highest rewards for the scientist who will prove the most cherished beliefs of the scientific community wrong. Of course, there's resistance because scientists are human beings and not always faithful to this credo. But to the extent that science is faithful to it, it's so powerful that you can go from, let's say, Galileo's first look through a telescope in 1609 to being beyond the edge of the solar system before 2009. You can gets you to the stars, and only because it's a mechanism that is so relentlessly testing its own beliefs. Imagine what politics would be like if the community of politicians were only interested in what was true and recognized that their best efforts to find the truth were doomed to failure, because there are no absolute truths that we can find. We can only find these little tiny successive approximations of reality. So Carl was truly a skeptic in the great tradition of science. He believed that in the absence of evidence, we have to withhold judgment. So that is not to say that he wasn't spiritual. That is not to say that he didn't have a sense of the sacred. He lived completely inside and out in a very spiritual way. But it was very important to him to reserve judgment and not to assume that he knew something that wasn't true. And so even in facing the deaths of his parents, who he loved very deeply, and facing his own mortality, he, in a very devout way, never, ever gave up that commitment to what he believed reality was.
You freely use the word sacred in describing his search for what moves him in the universe. That's not how a religious person would use the word sacred, I don't think. Could you clarify that?
Well, I don't think that the sacred necessarily has to do with the supernatural. In fact, I think the fact that we call the supernatural rather than the subnatural, reveals our contempt for nature, reveals our lack of a sense of how sacred life is. I mean, what is science telling us? It's telling us that we live as part of a 13.5 billion year continuity. That, as Carl said so magnificently, that we are star stuff, that every gene, bone, molecule of our physical reality, of ourselves, were formed in the hearts of distant stars. I mean, scientist is revealing the oneness of all things of life. It tells us in countless different ways. So for me, the natural is really the thing that we should hold highest, and that's something I learned from Carl, that nature is far more magnificent than anything we could imagine. And if we had a spiritual approach to nature, which was grounded in nature, as opposed to the conventional religions, which are in so many ways not only not grounded in nature, but contemptuous of what's natural, that might account for the fact that we seem to be unable to awaken ourselves from the kind of stupor that we're in terms of the way we treat each other and the way we treat this planet.
But allow me to be devil's advocate, or I guess it would be
Please.
God's advocate, for the moment.
Go ahead.
If you already seeded through your own thinking and through the philosophies of Carl Sagan, that, and through any sensible scientist, that we, whatever we know about the universe, it is surely the smaller fraction rather than the larger fraction of what is knowable
Amen.
Out there. If we seed that, and then you seed that what is not yet to be known could contain some forces, some elements that transcend what we now currently know or could possibly currently dream up. And someone who is a theologian might say, this is the foundation of their faith. The faith is anchored in the unknown that you have seeded that exists, that's out there. And so what can you tell me what kind of a conversation Carl would have with a theologian along those grounds?
He would say, I know what he would say. He would say, I have no problem with a faith that's rooted in the unknown. It's when you tell me that your faith is rooted in the known, that your understanding of what God is complete, that I have a problem. Mm. Is that fair?
Yeah, I guess it shut me up right there. Okay.
Pretty
good, right? That was a good answer.
I mean, he was saying that, of course, that the religious traditions have a lot to teach us about many things, and we are who we are as a result of the generations of people who've enunciated and articulated these values. But he would also say that, that science might be telling, from Carl's point of view, I think he would have said science was telling a greater story to him. And he wouldn't, for a moment, deprive anyone else of the right of loving a different story. But for him, the story that science was revealing was what moved him to his soul, what gave him goosebumps.
Steve, do you get goosebumps too? I mean, you're a scientist.
Oh, absolutely.
You get goosebumps.
Absolutely. There's nothing more, I think, moving, thrilling than contemplating this stunningly beautiful picture of the universe that's revealed by science.
I mean, I ask this because I'm just curious. There are plenty of scientists who come to work every day and they just sort of do their work, and they're surely in love with their work, but they're not running out telling everybody. They're not appearing on TV. They're not writing books. They don't feel this. So did Carl just have some feeling inside of him? Is it realistic to expect that feeling can and should be shared by everybody else?
Well,
or are we completely dependent
on
his poetry in order to feel this?
I don't know if that's true. I mean, he was a tremendous writer, a great poet, and had the capacity to really, if you'd been at those Gifford lectures and just seen the way that people just were absolutely pin-drop silent, really in the thrall. I mean, there's a man who was talking for about 15 hours, and yet the number of people just grew and grew and grew as the lectures, as the weeks went by, and the lectures and word of the lectures spread around Glasgow. He did have this great poetry, but it wasn't just the poetry. It was the truth of what he was saying, because I think there are a lot of us who feel a longing for that soaring spiritual uplift that is so human. It may be primate, there may be non-human primates who experience it also. But as a human, I know what that feeling is, and I know that in discovering the way that this discipline of science, which unfortunately because of the tension between religion and science, it's as if science ceded all of the inspirational moments to the religious side, you know, saying, okay, you guys won't burn us at the stake anymore, and we'll let you have all the great music and the great art. And those great, you know, and that great feeling.
Kind of a pact.
And maybe that's why this community of science was so rejected, the scientists who wanted to go forth into the public. I mean, the Roman Catholic Church realized in the 60s that holding the Mass in Latin was not the best idea in terms of engaging the faithful. Well, science was way behind in that. The community of science was way behind in that sense that, no, this is a kind of a priesthood. We'll speak in a language that no one else can understand.
Although we did give up Latin longer ago than that. But
they gave up the Latin, but instead they adopted a language that was as every bit as inscrutable for the layperson. And Carl was very much against that. He never spoke to impress people with how much he knew. It was always to communicate.
Steve, does... There are many who speak of the laws of the universe as some expression of something all-powerful, or the order of the universe as the handiwork of, if not intelligence, just something out there beyond us. How did Carl think about the order of the universe, the laws of physics? How did they sit within him? Was there a God of the laws of physics, as Einstein referenced?
Well, actually, it goes back to Spinoza, who was a Dutch philosopher in the 17th century, who wrote that, in some sense, the universe itself and the laws of its being is God, can be identified with God. And Einstein...
Literally or figuratively?
Both.
Both, okay.
Both. He felt that nature, that he worshipped nature.
Yeah.
Spinoza.
Yes. Spinoza.
Uh-huh.
And Einstein identified publicly with Spinoza's God, referred to it, and he also, on a number of occasions, explicitly rejected the depiction of God in conventional religions. He had no problem with Spinoza's God. And Carl said, if you ask me, do I believe in God? Well, first tell me, how do you define God? If it is a wide range from Spinoza's God, the God of the universe, of the laws of the universe, of the cosmos itself, which may be intelligent, it looks intelligent. From that at one end, all the way to an anthropomorphic, oversized, usually white man with a long beard who sits on a throne and tallies the fall of every sparrow. That's sort of the extreme range, at least in the West, of depictions of God. It's a huge spectrum. He said, where do you come down on that spectrum? If you say Spinoza's God, then well, surely no one would deny the universe, the existence of the universe, and the laws of the universe.
So we can say all this matter-of-factly, but yeah. Spinoza did not fare well with his contemporaries.
No, Spinoza, because of this and other heresies, he was Jewish, and he was excommunicated by the Jewish religious authorities.
I didn't even know you could do that. Can they do that?
Yes, but he's the only person I know of that was a Jew who was excommunicated by his co-religionists for this, and so he was outcast.
As you said, I don't even think Jesus was excommunicated as a Jew.
Not Marx,
right.
No.
So this was considered quite an affront.
Absolutely. And so Carl said, well, no one denies that the universe exists and its laws exist. If that's what you call God, then of course, no. I could not deny.
So that's indistinguishable from whatever we reveal.
If that's your definition, then God exists. I accept that. The evidence is for that. But he was interested in what is the evidence. He could not go beyond where there was no evidence.
And so I'm curious because when we speak of religiosity, you look at the public, just some data for the audience in case they were unfamiliar. There have been polls taken over the past century about how committed to religion the American public is. And the numbers are typically stay in the 90%, low 90s. They fluctuate, but they're up in the 90s. And it's in response to a question about not whether you go to synagogue or church every weekend, but whether you believe in a personal God who, for example, would answer your prayers. And that puts the question of, are you religious, at a pretty significant level if you say yes to that. And so when they do that, for Americans, it's up around 90%.
No, I beg to differ, Neil.
What?
Forgive me. But in fact, there was a very recent poll in the last month, which showed that, like so much of what we're led to believe, that's absolutely not right. That there's something like 34% said they do not believe in God. 37% in addition said we have serious doubts about the existence of God. And it was about a third who felt real conviction for that kind of
God. So what are these numbers that I just saw these numbers like a year ago.
Well, I think it's part of a campaign to make us feel that those of us who don't subscribe to this.
Okay, so let me finish the point, and that number would still work fine in the point I'm making. I was just simply saying that the religiosity in the public is higher than what you find in academia, for example.
Yes.
And it is higher in ordinary academia among sort of PhD research people than it is among PhD scientists. Mm-hmm. And it is higher among those who are ordinary PhD scientists from among those who are the elite scientists who, for example, are members of the National Academy. And so this number just keeps dropping, all right?
Right.
And so a point that I found fascinating is among the members of the National Academy of Sciences, let's think of them as for the elite scientists, as the creme of the creme, that number is not zero.
Right.
It's low, but it's not zero. It comes in at about 7%.
Exactly.
And so if it's not zero, you can't just extrapolate, oh, if you're religious, you're just not educated enough. Here are some of the highest educated, most talented scientists in the land, and that number does not go to zero. So do I go and knock on their door and listen to what they have to say about God? Or do I listen to Carl Sagan, who says he's got Spinoza's God, but he's certainly not praying to him? So if I don't otherwise know who to pick and listen to, what guidance do I have?
Well, there's 93% on one side and there's 7% on the other side. I mean, I feel that I think most of the 7% would say, I'm pretty sure, that science and religion are what is called non-overlapping magisterium. That there is a...
This is the title of Steve Gould's book. Well, the subtitle.
Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages.
Yes.
Yes, and it was a major theme in his book.
And may I say that I truly adored Stephen Jay Gould, and he and Carl were such great friends, and he's just one of my heroes. But I would like to respectfully disagree with him on this one issue. he argued in this book that there are these non-overlapping magisterium, which means that religion is one sphere of experience, which is not amenable to scientific investigation, and then science is another, which is somehow separate from our religious selves. And I would like to, I wish I could ask Steve this question for a million reasons, but it always occurred to me that, for one thing, even the people, the 7% of the National Academy who would say that they believe in a conventional religious traditional view of God, even those 7%, if you ask them, what about those religions that no longer have any living adherents? The worshippers of Zeus, let's say, or the, let's say, Aztecs. Can we study those religions scientifically and say, well, that there seems to be a cross-correlation between people who are agricultural and people who have certain gods? You can. There's a whole cultural anthropology which says that it's okay to look at them and see them as a kind of sociological reality influenced by their economic underpinnings, by the kind of technology they had, and their view of God. And yet, the surviving religious traditions are off limits and can't be understood in those terms. I don't think he would say that was true. And so, for Carl, there was only one magisterium, and that was nature. And the best way to have a deep understanding of nature was for him through science.
I suspect what is beyond the known is a much vaster, maybe infinite sea of the unknown, and science advances by extending that boundary. I suspect that if, in extending that boundary, we found something that was commensurate with traditional natures of God, it would then become part of nature, it would become part of the natural world, and Carl would have no problem with accepting it as if there was evidence.
Well, that's an interesting point. What you're saying is, that's a fascinating point. You're saying if you find something that's kind of godlike in some way, then you no longer need faith to believe that because you have the evidence in support of it. Yeah. And so then that just becomes simply part of nature.
Yes.
And so, or part of what is within the sphere of scientific investigation.
Carl was passionate.
So does it become science or does it stay religion?
It could be both.
Well,
it's a good question.
That is a good question. But let's remember that there was science and religion were one until the modern scientific revolution. Who were the creators of the modern scientific revolution? Copernicus, professional religious person.
Yeah.
Kepler, wanting to read the mind of God.
Mm-hmm.
Newton,
mm-hmm.
a obsessed. Biblical scholar obsessed with finding numerological significance in the Bible. All of these were religious people.
In fact, he wrote more on the subject of the Bible than he did on the subject of physics.
On physics,
Isaac Newton.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think this illustrates the point that they were, and Darwin. Darwin was going to be a country parson.
Mm-hmm.
And he says in his autobiography, if you had asked me when I was a young man, if every single one of the 57 articles of faith of the Anglican Church were the gospel truth, I would have said, of course they are.
Of course they are.
They are, absolutely. He didn't set out to in any way cause any trouble for any church or any religious people. All of these men were simply following where the science led. And what it led them to was an understanding, a deeper understanding of nature. And suddenly, things that were inexplicable, for instance, the clockwork motion of the planets, they became understandable in the context of gravity. And so what I think has happened is that after the scientific revolution takes off, there's a kind of compact between religion and science. And science says, okay, you know, as I said earlier, we'll leave you all of this great soaring emotional feeling, and we'll confine ourselves to a very elite priesthood, which will be very careful of who it lets in, and we'll only deal with things that aren't that interesting to everyone else. And religion, you know, was given complete and total control over
the
realm of human experience.
Is it fair to say you want science to reclaim access to the spiritual fulfillment one gets from doing science, if that had previously been ceded to the religious circles? Because there's nothing like a committed religious person speaking about some religious revelation they had. It is deep. It brings them to tears. Mm-hmm. This is an experience, an undeniable feeling that such a person has. And while there are times I get misty when I'm on a mountaintop looking up to the universe, there's no time when I'm like on my knees crying. Whereas that's not an uncommon scenario among people with a religious experience. So are we suggesting that science can actually be that for people who are either searching, or it'll give them something else to get misty-eyed about in addition to their religion? What is this offering that you're giving us here?
Well, a couple of things. That's a very deep question and beautifully expressed, as you express everything. And I have so many thoughts on this subject. It's absolutely my favorite subject. But maybe you didn't feel, maybe there have been religious moments which were distinct from how you feel mostly when you're doing science. But how did you feel when your children were born? And how did you feel when you first had the first glimpse of the vastness of time and space of which you were a part? It seems to me that
it was a completely humbling experience.
Right. Now, one religion is saying one thing. It's saying that, in effect, the universe was created for us, that we are, in a sense, the center of the universe, because it speaks, many of the religions do, speak of God creating the world, as if there weren't 400 billion suns in this galaxy alone, each perhaps with a retinue of maybe 100 worlds. So we were the center of the universe, and what science has taken from us has been very profound. But it's, to me, giving up that sense of your centrality in exchange for understanding that you are part of the greater fabric of nature is the defining experience of adulthood. That's what we need to do if we're going to grow up. When we're babies, when we're toddlers, we think of ourselves as the center of the universe. Science.
We all remember looking at the TV, sure that the host of the kids show we're watching knows
us.
We're talking just to us.
Exactly, exactly.
That was our friend on the TV.
When you have to, when it comes a time when you give that up, but what do you give it up in exchange for it in a healthy lifetime? What you get in return is so much greater than that delusion of centrality. And that's what science has done. It may not be trying to wrest back the spiritual reins of our consciousness, but what it has done, and nothing else could do it, it's the only thing I know of that has weaned us of our adolescent, pre-adolescent need to be central.
There's a story I don't think I've ever told publicly, not that it's a private story, but it just the occasion hasn't come up. This might be the one. The very first week that the Rose Center for Earth and Space opened, I got a letter in the mail from a professor of psychology at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia. And I saw it's interesting. The first week we're open, all right. First bag of mail to come in. And by the way, that show, which the two folks here co-wrote, was called Passport to the Universe, and it was a journey from Earth to the edge of the cosmos and then back. And while you're there, we kind of keep track of Earth as it recedes into nothingness, into sort of the infinite distant land that it is. And so this letter from this professor of psychology said, I've just seen the space show at the Hayden Planetarium. And first he introduced himself. I'm professor of psychology, and I specialize in all the forces around us that lead us to feel insignificant. And I said, bummer of a job, right? Man, what's that like going to the office every day? And he said, I've just returned from your space show, and needless to say, it was the greatest elicitor of feelings of insignificance that I have ever experienced. And then he said, I would like to do a survey of your visitors before and after to test what is their effect on their psychology. And then I thought about that. And then I said, well, do we part, counselors and psychologists out at the exit, for free pick-me-ups? Or is the real problem not that the show was a letdown, but that he came in with an ego that was too large to begin with? Because when I saw that show, I just thought of the immensity of the cosmos and that our, 15 pounds worth of head and brain matter figured that out. And so I kind of felt kind of large when I looked at it, but he didn't. He felt small. So how much of this is just, what is your ego walking into the problem? And maybe it's an ego management issue.
there were other letters that you got from people who said they were deeply moved.
Oh, yeah, others people who said they were brought to tears. To tears,
yes.
That's correct.
And they were thrilled.
Thrilled.
And thankful.
Thrilled. But this guy was a professor of psychology, so yeah. He's, you know, and no telling what he's doing now, you know, I don't know.
Well, I remember once Carl was giving a lecture at Cornell, and he was talking about what I call the great demotions that science had dealt us over the last 400 years in terms of constantly, you know, not at the center of the solar system, not at the center of the galaxy, okay, not at the center of the universe, just one after another, tiny little planet. And
we might not even be made of the stuff that most of the universe is made of.
Yeah.
That's another. That's,
oh, I didn't
add
want to
that
think
one.
About that.
You want to add that's like we're not even that, you know? Okay, but go on.
And afterwards, this young man came up to him, tremendous amount of feeling, and he said, "You now that you've taken all the meaning out of my life, what do I do?" And Carl looked at him and said, "Do something meaningful." And that's it. You know, it's like, I'm sorry, but it's like, you know, it reminds me in the old days when people used to talk about, you know, what's your sign? As if there was
That's not the old days. They still do that.
All right.
There's
well,
no old
not
days
so
about it.
Now. But it was like a kind of unearned identity, an unearned being special for some unearned reason. When, in fact, what I think what Carl was saying was that, you know, okay, so the universe is much bigger, much older than the greatest prophets ever dreamed. And look, we're all here together tonight. You know, the greatness of finding each other in the vastness, in the immensity. Being here alive at this moment. The universe has been here for 13.5 billion years, we think, at this moment. This planet has been here for 4.5 billion years. And here we are alive and conscious in the cosmos. And we live at a moment where the horizons, the identification horizons, our ability to respect and care for each other are expanding at a phenomenal rate. Two steps back, no question about it. Murder and mayhem, a lot of craziness. But I feel just such hope because it seems to me that every single day there are new discoveries and new examples of what we can take with these revelations of science and do to make this planet a better place to live.
Oh, okay. Steve, I know you had dug up a couple of quotes that you wanted to share with the audience. You had one about, which one was it? There was one that...
The Cosmos one about that.
You mean the end of Cosmos? Million.
Yeah, the Cosmos. Could you read that for people?
This is the final words of Cosmos, of the television series and the book.
So this would have been in the 13th episode.
Yeah.
And at the end of the book itself.
Yes. The 13th episode was called Who Speaks for Earth?
Who Speaks for Earth,
yes.
Okay.
We are the local embodiment of a cosmos grown to self-awareness. We have begun to contemplate our origins. Star stuff pondering the stars. Organized assemblages of 10 billion 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 atoms considering the evolution of atoms. Tracing the long journey by which, here at least, consciousness arose. Our loyalties are to the species and to the planet. We speak for Earth. Our obligation to survive is owed not just to ourselves, but also to that cosmos, ancient and vast, from which we spring. I would say that's the statement of a spiritually enlightened man.
Spiritually enlightened.
Yeah.
So... is that enough for people, do you think, to share that view? Or will there still be some gap? There are people who lost loved ones, who've lost children.
Yeah.
I get phone calls at least once a week from people who heard that you might be able to buy a star, and they want to buy a star in the name of their dead loved ones.
Yeah.
And I have to tell them that the company that does that is under investigation by, you know, I mean, it's this. Yeah. So what am I offering this person who is bereaved over the death of a loved one?
Yeah.
This is nice language. It's all beautiful. No one here is in denial of that.
Yeah.
But what solace does it give in time of need where religion has a whole system by which it can allow you to come to terms with just these kinds of incidents?
Well, I feel like I've had some experience with that kind of grief. And I've thought a lot about this in the last 10 years since Carl's death. And I have to say that Carl and I knew we would never see each other again. But
on his deathbed.
On his deathbed, we, you know. But our lovely daughter is here in the audience, Sasha Sagan. Now, to me, that is the embodiment of what is so precious and beautiful about life. And the fact is that, yes, I'll never see Carl again. But we spent 20 years together, and we gave each other every possible bit of ourselves. And we, and not only that, but because we were together, there are two children, Sam and Sasha, who's sitting somewhere over there. And I look at them every day, and I think, this is so much better than any supernatural story I've heard. Sasha and Sam carry within them the reality, the DNA of my love and Carl's love and our love for each other. Materially, not in some kind of nice poetic way, but in reality. What is greater than that? There's no story, forgive me, but visions of immaculate conceptions and things like that, they mean nothing to me compared to the human, the reality of human biology and the fact that when we come closest to each other, we can create new life forms that carry on that continuity that stretches back all those billions of years. And in them are the generations of human beings who've struggled. That is magnificent. And no supernatural story can compare with it.
Sasha, does she speak like this all the time? Where's the daughter? She's in the audience there. That's a lot to live up to, all right? You get your 4.5 billion years of genes. Steve, I know that the two of you agreed that you would read from The Pale Blue Dot, one of what I think one of the most powerful passages of scientific insight into the relationship between ourselves and the cosmos that I have ever seen or heard. And we have an image of the Pale Blue Dot. Annie, if you could introduce what the Pale Blue Dot is.
Yeah. Okay, well, I think
as an idea.
As I mentioned earlier, before Carl begged and pleaded for years, NASA did not want any cameras on the spacecraft. And after that was achieved, he asked that the Voyager spacecraft, which are the furthest things ever made by human beings, they are now out beyond the orbit of Pluto.
Of Neptune, yes.
Of Neptune. And No. I mean, we can say the orbit of Pluto without saying...
It's well into the Kuiper Belt.
They are now far out beyond. But in 1990, on Valentine's Day, after 10 years of Carl's nudging, NASA finally agreed to turn the cameras of camera of Voyager 2 out by the orbit of Neptune back towards Earth to look at our planet in the context of the wider universe, not the frame-filling Apollo image, which has been so important to our civilization, but now the Earth in the context of the solar system and the wider cosmos. And
so there's a book written with that as the title.
Called Pale Blue Dot.
Called Pale Blue Dot.
A masterpiece about the human future in space, as prophetic now as it was 15 years ago when it was written. And in it, Carl muses on this picture that he was responsible for taking.
Look again at that dot. That's here. That's home. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joys and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there, on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. The Earth is a very small stage in a vast cosmic arena. Think of the rivers of blood spilled by all those generals and emperors so that in glory and triumph they could become the momentary masters of a fraction of a dot. Think of the endless cruelties visited by the inhabitants of one corner of this pixel on the scarcely distinguishable inhabitants of some other corner. How frequent their misunderstandings, how eager they are to kill one another, how fervent their hatreds. Our posturings, our imagined self-importance, the delusion that we have some privileged position in the universe, are challenged by this point of pale light. It has been said that astronomy is a humbling and character-building experience. There is perhaps no better demonstration of the folly of human conceits than this distant image of our tiny world. To me, it underscores our responsibility to deal more kindly with one another and to preserve and cherish the pale blue dot, the only home we've ever known.
And I want to end on that note. You can't really follow a conversation with that after that quote, but I consider that one of the most powerful statements of the cosmic perspective ever penned. And so join me in giving one final thank you to Steve and Ann, and we'll go to questions now.